Welcome to Our Portland with Sarah Iannarone, made possible by contributors to Friends of Sarah for Portland. Portlanders have everything we need to make radical progress today on emergencies like climate chaos, housing affordability, and staggering inequality. Each episode, we'll hear how Sarah plans to be the mayor to lead the city of Portland to a more equitable and sustainable future. And now, here's Sarah.
Welcome to the Our Portland podcast. My name is Sarah Iannarone. My pronouns are she, her, and I am running for Portland mayor in the November 3rd election. In this episode, I cover a quick couple of news items and updates. I'll give you the tweet of the week, and then we're going to hear from Eddie Hill. He's an amazing community educator, land use planning expert, and has a lot of thoughts on what we can do to move Portland from food insecurity to food sovereignty. So I found something that I really liked, which is an outlet called Reasons to Be Cheerful. And what they posted this week was an article on how Portland makes local food work for everyone. And they talk about the Red on Salmon, which was instigated, if you will, by people in that industry and supported by EcoTrust. But I hope you'll take a look at that. We'll put the link in the show notes. Not only am I excited to see people talking about food sovereignty as critical infrastructure, the food insecurity that Portlanders are looking at in the face of COVID as an emergency situation. But I really like us talking about our community-led solutions to our greatest problems as something to be cheerful about. So I'm going to go back and keep looking at that Reasons to Be Cheerful website pretty frequently, just so I can stay upbeat and optimistic, that tactical optimism we're always talking about here at Sarah 2020, so that we can keep our eyes on the prize in terms of we really do have this Portland. So for those of you who've been down at the protests the last month under what Trump's occupation, if you will, of that block, certainly not of our city, and certainly our city is not under siege. You can be downtown just about any time, day of night, outside of that small few square block area where the courthouse is, and be perfectly fine, despite the narratives that the mainstream media at the national and international level would have you consider. However, there are some things that I think are going underreported. And one of them are the environmental and public health impacts of this gas. We've got Planned Parenthood out here doing surveys to watch for disruption of menstrual cycles. And I'm glad to see some of our state and national lawmakers coming together to talk about the environmental impacts of all of these chemical weapons that Trump has been deploying, and before him, Ted Wheeler with the Portland Police. But the Portland Bureau of Environmental Services, according to Willamette Week, is going to investigate the federal rinsing of tear gas into storm drains. And other lawmakers have called on US EPA to investigate. So this just came out yesterday, that after video surfaced of federal agents hosing contaminants off the Marco Hatfield Federal Courthouse, BES said the discharging technique is not permissible and that the city agency is currently investing. You're not allowed to hose contaminants into the street and into storm drains. There's no permit for this, they tweeted out, because that kind of discharge is not permissible. And we do not expect to know what's actually going on as they continue the investigation. However, you can't be putting chemical weapons into the storm drains. It flows into our sewer system and the runoff goes into our river. And so I'm so glad that one of my favorite state representatives, Karen Power, worked with our congressman, Earl Blumenauer, to call on the US EPA and Oregon DEQ to investigate which chemical agents are being used on protesters and how that impacts human health, wildlife, aquatic life, and local air and water quality. Gases have been deployed on peaceful protesters with little or no prior notice, resulting in exposure to unknown chemical agents, Blumenauer and Power wrote, and we are extremely concerned about the potential environmental and public health impacts of these gas discharges. I share this concern, and I'm grateful for representatives like them in Salem and in D.C. advocating on our behalf, because when it comes right down to it, racism is a public health crisis, as we talked about last podcast. But these militarized responses to community-led protests in the streets is also a threat to human health and environmental health. I'm recording this on Friday, so maybe by the time you listen to this, more will have come out. This is obviously the beginning of the conversation, even as we are negotiating right now the drawdown of those federal troops in Portland. It looks like Kate Brown came in to clean up Ted Wheeler's mess. I'm not sure. I'm trying to keep a close eye on what's happening in that transition time. Sometimes it feels like we're swapping out one force for another. Yesterday, I missed Ted Wheeler's press conference because I was busy watching John Lewis's funeral. Most of us were busy watching important event, witnessing former President Obama comport himself with grace, dignity, and respect that so many of us miss from the highest leader in our nation. But meanwhile, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler thought it was a good time to host a press conference, I guess. And he said, with admiration, according to the Oregonian Politics Twitter account, that Portland Police Bureau had only deployed tear gas on protesters twice during July. Mayor Wheeler was proud of that fact. I guess gassing us two times in July is an accomplishment under this administration. That was after there was a restraining order against gassing us. So hip hip hooray, I guess. He also said that the use of sound cannons and multiple indiscriminate uses of tear gas by Portland police on his watch should, quote, never have happened, unquote, and says he takes personal responsibility and is sorry. I just don't think people want to hear, oops, I did it again, from our elected officials. They really don't. They're tired of it. I sit through meetings with individuals, with civic leaders for community groups, listening sessions, and what I hear time and again is that people in Portland are sick of the failure to lead, the empty words, and the broken promises. I sat with a group of women last night who are working on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls issues. The sorrow, the disappointment, the lack of hope and trust in our leaders was heartbreaking. And at the same time, I know we can be doing better, because these militarized police responses that we're sending out to every single social problem that we're facing, drug addiction and abuse, send the police. Domestic and intimate partner violence, send the police. People unhappy about police brutality, send in the police to brutalize them. We have to come up with a different response. Who will people call when they don't feel safe? Who will they trust to answer that call? This is a conversation that we're going to need to have as Portlanders. And I am so grateful for Commissioner Joanne Hardesty leading on a historic vote this week out of city council to actually put a citizen oversight initiative onto the ballot in November. I guess it's not an initiative because it was referred to the ballot, but there's a measure on the ballot this November to actually start reining in Portland police. And so I hope you'll take a look at that, check out what they're asking for, and get behind that ballot measure. But that brings us, I think, to the tweet of the week. There was some news this week reported by Willamette Week that Ted Wheeler broke city elections law again. I'm not going to go too deeply into this. It looks like the city elections office has fined Ted Wheeler's campaign $2,000. He's failed to include required disclosures about contributors and accepted again and continues to accept contributions in excess of the cap passed by 87.4% of Portland voters called honest elections, which means you can't take campaign contributions in excess of $500. I'm just going to say this was passed a while back, and my team decided from day one that adhering to campaign finance law and not accepting large contributions was going to be our practice for the duration. This law has been in effect the entire campaign. We've always adhered to it. We've always thought that even while it was tied up in the courts, if 87.4% of Portlanders voted for it, it's clearly demonstrated that a majority of the people support that. But Ted Wheeler, he doesn't seem to care. Not only did he roll the dice that his side would win in court, and they lost, but they continued to fail to actually do the campaign finance reporting that they need to do. And so there are people who are watchdogs who actually keep an eye on people's campaign finance reporting. I think it's one of the most important things we do in our local elections, frankly, is scour Orastar, which I call, you know, which I look at in the Oregon Secretary of State website pretty frequently to see who's taking money from whom and when and what comes with that money. But Wheeler's campaign manager didn't see it that way, and their team called the examination of Wheeler's donors borderline harassment. I quote you, and I'm kidding you not, borderline harassment, and that the mayor's being held to an unfair standard. And I quote, the fact that there is neither, I'm sorry, I have to laugh. I can't help but laugh at this. I'll try to be serious. I quote, the fact that there is neither a grace period or safe harbor allowed under a new complex set of rules that requires significant time and expertise is without precedent in our city. I guess, I don't know, it made me laugh a little bit there because really, I manage thousands of donations via my campaign. My team is a very professional, they're adept, and they just make this a priority and make it happen. And that leads us to our tweet of the week. Taylor, rose emoji, unicorn emoji, at 10TPDX tweeted this about that Willamette Week report. It's so funny to me that when men are held accountable, they consider it harassment. I am with you, Taylor. And I'm just going to leave it at that. If you think being held to account for breaking the law is harassment, you might be living under different sets of rules than the rest of us. That said, if you want a mayor who thinks that campaign finance regulation and open and accountable elections and government transparency and not being beholden to special interests should be the cornerstone of how local elections and local government works, you might want to shoot me a few bucks. We're asking people to give us $6 because that's how many times we've at least caught Wheeler breaking those campaign finance laws. So go to sarah2020.com/donate, throw $6 our way if you've got it. Sign up for $6 a month recurring between now and November. That would be August, September, October. It's $18 between now and Election Day. So if you can afford it, $6 one time or $6 recurring would certainly help us as we head into that warm summer month of August so we can get the news about our campaign and all the good things we're trying to do out to the public.
Show your support for Sarah by purchasing a t-shirt, face mask, or bumper sticker at sarah2020.com/store. All items are sold at cost, but please consider adding a donation to your order.
We are so blessed today to have Edward Eddie Hill here. He's co-director of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition. He's going to talk with us today. Good morning, Eddie.
Morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. Now, this is a conversation that'll set you on your heels because you've got two people who like to think a lot and talk a lot. Edward Hill is an innovator. He's a driver of work. He works in so many aspects of sustainable placemaking, sustainable community building. He's a polymath, really, when it comes to food justice, food systems, BIPOC food economies for Black and Brown people in the Pacific Northwest. He's got a background in farming. He's got a background in planning. He's worked in cities around the world, helping them understand how they can do better. And so we're very happy to have him here with us this morning. Eddie, how are you?
I am good, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
So you're working on this project, the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition, and I want to talk about that. But I want to let folks know that you and I go back prior to this moment in terms of that period of time when Portland was still perceived, I think, largely as the sustainability leader. You and I were both working in this field of making sure that, you know, people around the world had a good sense of what best practices were coming out of Portland and where we needed to be in that. And I found a picture of you from Williams Avenue back in 2015, with Bordeaux. We had hosted the region of Bordeaux. That's a very important wine region in France, and it's critical to their economy. So maintenance of that land and that agriculture was critical, but they knew that they needed to engage the community in that. So you came and talked with them, and I'm going to read you a quote because you probably don't remember it. You said, "Context is everything. Nothing you see here is accidental, but most often it's poor people and bureaucrats are who are left to clean up the mess that the market leaves behind."
I said that?
You said that. You're so smart.
Wow, that was a very cogent and aware moment. that's good to know. And that's 2015?
That was 2015. And I think we've met prior. Yeah,
and that's true. Yeah. Yeah, that was I remember some of the projects that were triggering at that time and the conversations, and actually Kat Guggenhauer was still here with the Right to Root stuff was just kind of curving up. That was important. And then Japan, right? Didn't we do a tour with Japan?
We've done so many. We've done Japan. Yeah. You stopped in on that Project for Public Spaces when we were over at on DECOM. That was a high level delegation. Those were all leaders. We've interfaced multiple times. Yeah. But I think, you know, looking back at where we were even, you know, 5 years ago, if not 10, where do you see Portland still leading, if anywhere?
I think Portland is leading in, and I'm not, you know, I'll try to find a way to make this serious. Mm-hmm. I think Portland right now is leading in a demonstration of what losing or fumbling, I've considered the last couple of years fumbling. And for Portland and the work I did with Eco Districts and Rob Bennett and that team, and watching that program fumble, and the fumbling has occurred. It's sort of the best practices, but best examples of what not to do with all of your assets and all of your brain trust and all of your community capacity to help turn and shift leading with innovation. And the forcing out of Kat Guggenhauer and the Right to Root being taken up as a beacon of a planning document that if implemented a few years ago could have helped to curve off some of the losses, I think, the last 36 months in the Black and Brown communities in Portland, and the inability for municipal staff, folks who were driving, you know, because when I first came to Portland in 2013 and had been working with people with the food policy, the Multnomah Food Policy Council disbanded in 2012, 2013, 2014, a lot of the downtown projects kind of stalled out, and the equity road mapping work began to sort of stall and, you know, stopped at the, hey, if we hire more people of color, if we engage more contractors, then everything's okay. And that was the least you know, that was the, you know, those are the last things that really make an impact in terms of equity work. So I think a potential positive flourishing of ideas and innovation at the intersections of equity and urban planning and spatial equity and restorative justice was missed in from 2017 to now, where now it's, I mean, in some ways, forcibly and wonderfully, we have nature and biology forcing us to come back to these topics like the food policy council and a regional food system, a localized food system, or ensuring that different types of housing, not just affordable housing and you know, and market rate, you know, the 60% median workforce housing, for some reason that word went away in 2011. So that I think there's this we rested on our laurels. We rested on this, on the bike lanes. We rested on the transit, and we've got buses, and we've got the equity roadmap. And then people forgot to start walking down the roadmap. And then it became disaggregated. You know, a lot of the Black led programs continue to be fragmented. You had, you know, Verde on the north side, sort of like neighborhoodism, you know, Cully was doing Cully's work. Northeast was doing something, and North is doing St. John's, you know, sort of fractured versus coming together. You know, we went more libertarian than we did liberal for, you know, and I was a little concerned. I've been concerned, having had contacts, or I have deep contacts in city government and, you know, both nonprofit NGO work here, and coming into this crisis we have now, from the earthquake planning to, you know, city planning for disaster on down to, you know, basic communication between community-based organizations seems to have not been our forte. So, yeah. So here we are now, you know, now we have to address those things. And I think there's a forcing function that's occurring where now we can come back to these things because people are hungry, national food system's broken. And if we happen to have something else happen, you know, like one of the other things we were waiting for to occur naturally in this region, I think we're realizing now that a lot of our systems and a lot of the ways that we thought that we could lean on systems and community resources are not actually in place. So I see a wonderful opportunity to pivot, but again, it needs a will, you know, just like businesses here. And if you don't want to pivot, if you're a restaurant and you don't want to pivot to takeout because you're too foo-foo or you can't see it, which happens, you know, like Ed, then you're not going to make it versus restaurants that are like, hey, serve food to the homeless in the morning and train a couple of people and then clean the place out. And then in the evening, we can do takeout specialty dinners for 150 people. And I'll only make that many and keep half my staff on. You know, there's a way to innovate all situations that I think if we truly are a sustainability, a city of sustainability and resilience, then right now we're not demonstrating that in a way that benefits those most at risk and most in the path of those things damaging them even further. Focusing on, again, you know, one of the positive things about Multnomah County, about our region, is we have a lot of data about equity and who's not being taken care of. And it's very easy, at least it was for me and a few other people, to look at that data and say that BIPOC communities now are the communities that are going to be most impacted. Now, you know, we also have the houseless community and, you know, a Black trans community who are houseless. We have people who are stacked on that, you know, in terms of additionals. But in terms of county data and city data, the economic responses or the economic condition, the housing condition, the nutrition and health condition of Black and Indigenous populations, primarily Native Americans of tribes or urban Indians who have moved from other locations to come to Portland, and African Americans and Africans now, because African Americans in second and third generation phase are African Americans. They are no longer immigrants and refugees. Their children are being impacted by the same types of psychological, physical, nutritional, and educational and systemic problems that African-American children are being impacted. So we have a new population. We're doubling the population or increasing the population of African-Americans because we have new second, third generation. Let's take remove that term. They are now African-Americans or Africans in America, or we're now them and they are now that demographic has grown. So the BIPOC community focus for now, similar to women's rights or civil rights for, you know, the African-American or Black, you know, community civil rights movement. All of those things spread for everyone. Bike lanes did not equally, just like a Pano, you know, they dealt with those issues, and now we're shifting to climate change. But I think being innovative means we have to take risk. And for some reason, we're not taking the types of risks that will benefit and impact most positively those that have continued to be left out and negatively impacted.
So let's talk about that a little bit further, though, because you always drop so much wisdom in answering a single question.
Oh my goodness, yes.
There's never any small talk with us. We always go right to it. But here's the thing. I mean, innovation is key in that community resilience at the core and the fast pivot. I like to call it the art of the fast pivot in some ways. But that's only possible when you're strong, right? It's only possible when you're resilient. It's only possible when you're equipped. And what we're seeing is that some of this is about innovation, but what you're doing with food right now and food sovereignty and land sovereignty is as old as it gets, right? Mm-hmm. It's so essential. And you and I are both land use people at the core, because yes. We look at these human systems and we see them overlaid on this land. And right. We talk about place and connection to place as being such a key driver in how we engage communities. So tell me about, you know, what are you thinking in terms of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition? Why that? Why now? And how can we intensify our investments in what we know works to address some of the problems that you illustrated and highlighted in your first answer?
Yeah. So, you know, with the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition, it was a 15-year strategic plan and a regional strategy. And I've been onboarding working with folks in Seattle, Tacoma, African-American growers, Black growers, African refugees and immigrants, people. This is, you know, 5-6 years ago, and now folks have kids and farms, things like that. I've continued to look at, and I think part of that innovative thinking is thinking, going and thinking in places, just like at University of Washington in 2007, when they were talking about food systems, you know, and they were like, food systems, urban planning, APA wasn't even interested in it. And they didn't take that on until, you know, 2010, 2012 as an official thing. So there's this aheadness that for some reason I've been given, you know, the ability to do with other folks who have that skill like yourself to look ahead of the current situation, look ahead of the problem, and say, if that problem is solved, what's the next problem? So if we have a transit line or a yellow line going all the way up to the north end, then what's the next problem in terms of development in between the stations, right? So I took the similar, and some of those tours we took, you know, we did the downtown South Waterfront back before, this was what, 2008, 2007. And, you know, before they, and the city of Seattle coming down here, and then people from Portland going up. So the shared information has showed me in terms of food systems work for the last decade is that there aren't very strong, in terms of that urban growth boundary, there's very little activity and especially here in Oregon, and there's very little will in King County. If you look at it, Multnomah and King County, Seattle versus Portland and Portland in terms of addressing these food system issues. And I took that information and condensed it into what do I know in the event, or what do we know in the event of things not working, what's going to be most important in terms of getting food to people and nutrition, because you can't without people being fed. I mean, it's a hunger strike, right? So it's either a revolution or it's a hunger strike. So people needing to be fed is a key thing. The civil rights movement was what the most famous people of the civil rights movement were the farmers. that fed and the people and the chefs and the cooks and the people who fed the civil rights movement that nobody knows names about. There's never like, hey, here's the farmer who delivered the food to Selma before they did the March on the Bridge with John Lewis. So this, for me, I like that. I like that kind of George Plimpton behind the scenes investigative journalist turned practitioner, right? So how about we try to get Black people and African immigrants together? How about we create a, in the Northwest specifically, because we're not in the South, create a block of people that want to do that work and economically can benefit from it, because access to being a housing developer and access to being a farm creator are radically different income streams and cash capital on the deck. There's already a strong white-led gardening training programs around the region for immigrants and refugees and low-income people. So instead of trying to recreate that wheel, level up and build a system from where Black people stop being gardeners and want to be farmers and before they get to market. So our strategy has been getting folks to market, not just as farmers, but as food producers, food makers, import, export, anything that has to do with soil remediation, soil rebuilding. I've always thought that indigenous people, Native Americans, and Black folks are the folks who can be enlisted in the American sense of the word, but also deployed with funding, radical amounts of funding, to be that WPA model that goes out and begins the stabilization of these urban and have the green ring of food around it. Our county currently does not, and Metro does not have a tri-county agriculture plan. That is ludicrous in the face of this. I'm talking to staff members there and people at the highest level of management, not leadership, but the decision makers haven't gotten this yet, but there's no agriculture land management program formally here. There's a bunch of good old boys that have been able to lease, county land or Metro land to grow whatever crops they wish, but there's no coordinated structure. There's no food office in the city to coordinate this work. There's no food policy council because it was disbanded. So
there's not even an emergency plan right now. I mean, I've been cooking at Blanchet House and trying to volunteer at the shelters, and they have a guy who doesn't even have enough cold storage. Right. So we're not even coordinating. Coordinating supply chains and things like that regionally.
Yeah. There are restaurants. There are companies that have shut down that have these facilities that they're waiting for COVID. I talked to them a month ago and they were like, hey, COVID will be over in 3 weeks. It'll be over in a month and we'll be okay and be back to normal. And now, I have neighbors that's done. This is 2020. This is what 2020 is. And if the vaccine starts to work, if it doesn't turn us into zombies, if all of these things don't occur, then we still have a curve and a change in our lives and our system that regionalizes and localizes food. So infrastructure, something you just mentioned, that food infrastructure and knowing how much free, available, not free, but paid for and in the market resources are available is something, like you said, we don't have a resource map yet. And we are out right now identifying companies and calling and getting calls and wanted to be that magnet because we knew something was going to occur. So when it turns on, people start, well, who's the Black farming people that are doing this? Or who are the folks that are taking food boxes? So now that we've gotten out of the initial USDA dump of food and shifting of the commodity crops into the community, now we're starting to see meat, cows and chicken and fish come in that's being redirected from all of the restaurants and all of the food locations that are being shut down. There's this plethora, 50,000 pounds of sable fish is being shipped here. And I just met the guy. He wants to get it out to community. I'm like, I can't store 50,000 pounds of sable fish right this minute.
I don't even know if Portlanders eat that much in a year.
Right. Thank you. Same thing. People are, like a million pounds of potatoes came in, right? And I'm like, I can't do anything with a million. I can't store a million pounds of potatoes right now. So we don't have the county or the city food infrastructure to dump the food that we need for a year. We don't have enough. We don't have a co-packing facility in the city. We don't have a food processing center that people can access affordably. So again, we've come to the point where it's not housing, it's not transit, it's, we've took care of those. It's not biking, it's not electric vehicles, it's meals, it's access to food, it's healthcare, it's identifying where people are in terms of, you know, it's on the street with that, with the homeless camps that are, and the blocks of houses now, tent homes and the new tents. And this is a permanent condition that I feel very, very, very strongly that organizations like ours, as we're building it to work both for the people, for the economy, and for the planet, and for spirit. Now you got quadruple bottom line. Finally, they added spirit and culture. Thank you for adding the last thing. That's the first thing in our community, right? So we start with spirit and culture, and the last thing that dominant culture puts into their economic planning is spirit and culture. So,
well, it's hard to commodify that, Eddie, so we wouldn't want to give you credit for it.
No, don't give me credit at all.
You see what I'm saying? Like, I don't think if we can't measure it in terms of economic value off the top of our heads, our society doesn't really have much care for it. We don't invest in it. It's the same with mental health and a lot of other things.
No, not at all.
So, before we sign off, I want to hear, you know, we're looking at potentially a 40% increase in homelessness due to COVID-related unemployment. Mm-hmm. We're looking at hunger. I'm looking at the poverty crisis as Portland's next mayor, thinking, you know, what am I going to do? So talk to me about two things before we sign off. What does the city need to do for this movement? And that can be WPA level, because we do have access to money, and what should we be doing? And then two, what can people who are watching today or listening on the podcast do to help you and your project specifically?
Okay. The city, having watched and you know, like you mentioned at the beginning, we've seen some folks from all over the world come to town, and we've got to talk, we've gotten the opportunity to talk to those folks from Japan and South Africa, I mean, and gone to those places and watched their systems. What I think the city, you know, like the punch list on the city for this challenge specifically is to get people fed, right? A local food initiative that ties with Metro and does a tri-county regional, not a food console, like a food, you know, it's no discussion anymore. We know what's broken. We know it's the food assessment. How many refrigeration, you know, how much refrigeration do we have? How many kitchens do we have? Whose kitchens are dormant and dark at night? And how do we get those places active, not 24/7, but double the activity of food prep, food storage, and start to have a tactical office that helps coordinate and map available agriculture lands, available food production areas, available community organizations that are ready to, this is a green workforce. Work Systems is ready to put dollars on this in terms of green workforce. We have a green loop that doesn't have any agriculture in it. We have a green boundary. We have an urban growth boundary that doesn't have an ag and food systems management, where we just like concrete, right, or gravel or salt. Any other, I think food is food systems are a critical infrastructure, just like sewers, electricity, water, and high-speed internet. So that's that important. And there's a way to not only monetize it for community, but there's a few community food system ownership and a benefit that can come and be distributed, just like we have overages with like electricity. If we had a solar grid, we could sell energy back to, you know, back to PGE or whoever else, you know. So having this district food system, like a district energy profile, I think is critical. So an office of food and farms in the city, in the mayor's office, and then coordinating with other offices and municipal offices that will be forced by that innovative, fantastic approach to, just like climate change, create those offices and gather with you to make this thing happen.
You think that's more of a planning process, or do you throw that right in emergency management and resilience?
No, I think that's I think that's a both and. I think a lot of our work now with planners is both and. It is both planning and action. It is tactical urbanism at its most perfect, you know, when I think of tactical urbanism, it's like this. It's like, we got a problem. We're in the red parking lot. We set up a temporary food hub. We got a market going on Mondays with AFMA, and, you know, it come through market every other Monday, running to the end of the year, using that indoor outdoor space at the red that was sitting dormant because no longer can they offensive parties. So those kind of opportunities to leverage and step up and meet with Randy Miller and Olympic Provisions and EcoTrust and find a way to not diversify their work, but help them find their way about how to stabilize our work and make our work resistant to the shocks and stressors and start to take root. So I think in the food economy is one of the best ways that Black and Indigenous people can take firm root and have longevity in this state in terms of an industry, agriculture, food systems, regenerative agriculture, soil building, animal husbandry, food production, you know, food making. Black Food Sovereignty Coalition, the best way to help us, blackfoodnorthwest.org. We're on Instagram at Black Food Northwest, and we are identifying those farmers. If there are Black and Indigenous farmers that want help, reach out to us. Folks who are ready to scale up on food products, we're working with the Red and with AFMA and Oregon State University's Community Food Systems Program. Shantae Johnson with Mudbone Grown, she's on the State Agriculture Advisory Commission. I'm on the OCSFN, Oregon Farm to School, and then Oregon Small Farms and Community Food Systems. So again, we're doing political work, but a lot of our work is immediately going into those rooms and saying, we have punch lists of immediacy that need to happen. Compost needs to be shipped over to this farm. These farmers need a refrigerator. These folks need a tractor. Let's move this over here, you know. So, and I'm sorry, one more thing is we have a lot of businesses and also developments that are, as this economy collapses more, and we're going to have these empty lands, there has to be a more robust, and I when I was at PBOT in 2013, they were working on this and haven't finished it yet, alternative uses for rights of way. There's formal food-based environmental restoration plan for putting trees, cleaning, you know, making it green everywhere, not just in certain communities or on bike lanes, but there's a resilience and shocks and stressors plan that we need that is much more robust than a disaster management plan. Because we were doing disaster management, and I thought we had a report if there's an earthquake, and I'm not quite sure why the book wasn't opened up and you just change, copy and paste, or, you know, like replace earthquake with COVID, and then we could have fixed everything, but I don't think that book was really a real book. So,
yeah, maybe it was just a book jacket, Eddie. I don't know. But we're writing the book. We're writing the book. We're writing the book. And that is the beautiful thing about Portlanders. We never stop. We stay optimistic and we stay in the fight. And I know that Portland is happy to have you. We are so grateful for your continued work. We're so grateful for your thoughtfulness, too, because your leadership on these issues of having to force us time and again back to where we need to keep our eyes on the prize as opposed to looking off here is so critical. So thank you. Thanks for taking time out of your morning to be with us. If folks want to follow up, I'm going to give you that one more time. It's blackfoodnw.org, and you can follow up, get more information, donate if you can, do whatever you can to support these organizations because they actually have all the knowledge and wisdom and capacity that we need, but we just need to make sure it's fully funded and unleashed to do that work on behalf of our community. So thank you, Eddie. We appreciate you. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Our Portland. If you have a question for Sarah, record a voice memo on your phone and email it to ourportland@sarah2020.com. Or use the Our Portland hashtag and send us a message on social media. This has been a production of Friends of Sarah for Portland, with matching funds from Portland's open and accountable elections.